Welcome to Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine, focusing on a main story. I'm Marko Suprin for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the main stories that happened this week. Lyuba is a prisoner in her own home. "For 3 years, I've been sleeping in my clothes," she said. Lyuba Sorokina, a 70-year-old resident of Avdiivka, a town that is under constant fire and shelling, was interviewed by Hromadske Radio correspondent Katerina Kadr this week. Her story is the story of millions of residents of eastern Ukraine living with the consequences of Russia's invasion. Most of her family have left and are scattered around Ukraine. There are more internally displaced people, IDPs, in Ukraine than there are Syrian refugees in Europe. Think about that. Russia invaded and occupied Crimea, and then invaded and occupied parts of Ukraine in the east. Ukrainians left their homes, but did not leave their country. My granddaughter is living in Vinnytsia, because that's where they evacuated the Donetsk National University, she said. Lyuba also lives with the loss of her daughter-in-law, who died from catastrophic blood loss when she was wounded by shrapnel. Some of her neighbors call her a traitor behind her back, because she helps feed members of the Ukrainian armed forces that are stationed near her home. One of her neighbors warned her that she should be careful, because one day the DNR will come there and make her pay. To which Lyuba says, "I'm 70 years old. What they would do is all the same to me." The story is in Ukrainian, but we'll include a link on our site. Find someone who speaks Ukrainian to have it translated. It's worth your time. Almost immediately following the creation of the Donetsk People's Republic, they set up a ministry for state security, and they regularly release videos of Ukrainian prisoners of war. This week, they released a video of Lilia Kotz, who was taken captive about 4 months ago. She was part of the movement that created the Ukrainian Volunteer Army, formerly part of the Right Sector, that had units stationed in the occupied territories. Hromadske Radio interviewed her former commander, who goes by the call sign Chervin, about the video, and he claims that she was most likely tortured. The Security Service of Ukraine, the SBU, said they will be verifying the information about her capture. The SBU also announced the capture of an agent of the Russian Federation's Army General Staff in the western city of Rivne. The agent was caught while trying to recruit an officer of the Ukrainian army, offering him and his family Russian citizenship and money. The curator of the agent is one Oleksandr Ilyukin, who works for the Russian military intelligence. The Ukrainian officer to whom the offer was made reported this to the SBU, and in a special operation had the recruiter arrested. Now, the Security Service of Ukraine is the state agency that is technically charged with administering the release of Ukrainians being held by the Russian occupation authorities. To date, 3,082 Ukrainians were found and released, out of which 1,484 were civilians and 1,598 were members of various branches of Ukraine's armed forces. 111 Ukrainians remain in captivity, 9 of which are being held on the territory of the Russian Federation, according to the SBU. Later in the show, we'll hear from Dmytro Potyakhin, a local Ukrainian activist who was held against his will by the DNR for almost 50 days in 2014. Ukrainian citizens Mykola Korpyuk and Stanislav Klich lost their appeal in the Russian appellate court this week and will remain behind bars in a Russian prison. Like Oleg Sentsov, the Ukrainian filmmaker sentenced to 20 years of hard labor by a Russian kangaroo court, they were captured in Ukraine and taken to the Russian Federation in 2014 and have been charged with killing Russian nationals during Russia's war against Chechnya. The appeal was attended by several ambassadors from the European Union, as well as former prisoner of war and member of parliament Nadia Savchenko. Savchenko said she attended the hearing because Ukrainian media failed to cover the plight of Ukrainians held in Russian prisons. Quote, "When no one from Ukrainian media report on their status, when European parliamentarians remain silent, it is very difficult for them, that is the prisoners, to not feel support," she said. Korpyuk and Klich are being held in a temporary isolation facility in the city of Grozny, Chechnya, and took part in the hearing via video link. In an article that appeared on Euromaidan Press, well-known journalist Vitaly Portnikov said what a lot of people were thinking, that Savchenko was trying to win political points at home, and that she is, quote, "a person that can become a factor in destabilizing Ukraine, a live bomb." He also said that, quote, "we need to stop thinking about Savchenko and her attempts to live up to her own image, and instead to focus on those remaining in Putin's dungeons. It is better to channel our energy and emotions for these people." Meanwhile, Savchenko's own lawyer, Mark Fagan, also commented that her presence in Moscow at the trial actually does more harm to Ukrainian political prisoners than good. It creates the impression, at least in the Russian information space, that the situation between Ukraine and Russia is tense but without animosity, and that Ukrainians can freely visit Russia. Fagan said that in the current atmosphere in Moscow, any Ukrainian, quote, can be arrested and be accused of anything, and that spontaneous visits like this create a false sense of security. The Ukrainian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, for their part, has called for Karpyuk's and Klyk's immediate release. The town of Stanitsa Luhansk remains a hotspot. Russian occupation proxies set up a sniper ambush across the Siversky River, lasting for about an hour. They continue to use 120mm caliber weapons that are supposed to be forbidden by the Minsk Agreement. One Ukrainian soldier was wounded on October 26th in the Donetsk sector by an explosive device. The town of Avdiivka continues to be the site of intense battles, including mortars and heavy weapons. Colonel Lysenko noted that, as usual, the weapons are fired from the east. On October 27th, Russian-backed proxies launched over 220 mortars at Ukrainian positions along the Krasnohorivka, Marinka, Pavlopil, Shirokine line. There were 19 attacks of heavy munitions and 43 firearm incidents. One Ukrainian soldier was killed and three were wounded. According to Colonel Motuznyak, Ukrainian police, in a routine inspection, stopped a shipment from the war zone that was headed for the city of Zaporizhia. The package contained 6 rounds of ammunition, a grenade, and narcotics. A member of Ukraine's National Guard, Maxim Kasyanov, released drone footage filmed over the occupied city of Luhansk. These pictures are impressive for what's missing. There's almost no movement, no cars, and looks very similar to aerial photos taken of North Korea. We'll include a link to the photos on our site. The OSCE continues to maintain that all sides to the conflict should remove troops and equipment from the contact line in a move they tout will build trust. At a meeting of the Trilateral Contact Group, Martin Sadek from the OSCE, also known as Captain Obvious, said that keeping to a ceasefire would quickly bring about a de-escalation of the conflict. The OSCE continues to move for elections in the regions and the implementation of the Steinmeier formula, which now includes an amnesty component. In response, Ukraine suggested that the quasi-government structures that were created in the occupied territories be dismantled. Darka Olifer, press secretary for Ukraine at the ongoing talks in Minsk, said that, quote, elections on territories not under Ukrainian control, in which we find 40,000 members of a foreign army and equipment, is not possible. At the Warsaw Security Forum this week, former president of Estonia Tomas Kendrick had a case of déjà vu all over again. He was talking about the mood in Estonia following their independence about joining NATO, that is, that people thought it better to not rock the boat, and that he sees the same thing happening now. He said, quote, I see this happening in Ukraine today. We've witnessed an invasion, and part of their territory has been occupied, referring to the Russian occupation of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula and portions of its eastern territories. Quote, there are thousands of armed soldiers of the Russian army, and still a portion of the people continue to say, don't rock the boat. Estonia also announced that the 2017 Eastern Partnership Summit that will include Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus should be held in Brussels and not Riga when Estonia will be chairing the European Union. The United Kingdom announced that it will be stationing 800 members of Her Majesty's Armed Forces in Estonia, one of the first anticipated moves made by NATO to calm fears in the region regarding threats made by Russia to the Baltic country's security. French and Danish troops are expected to join their UK counterparts in the spring of 2017. NATO General Secretary Stoltenberg also announced at a press conference this week that they have confirmed 2 Russian warships in the Baltic Sea. Now, this is interesting. The 2 warships, Zeleny Dol and Serpukhov, were cited and identified as the same ships that launched cruise missiles at targets in Syria. The home port of these 2 ships is Sevastopol on the occupied Crimean Peninsula. Earlier, it was thought that the 2 ships would be returning to the Mediterranean. However, the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense's main intelligence directorate issued a statement back in September that the ships were to be transferred to the Baltic via Russia's inland waterways. Apparently, they were right. At the same time, NATO also decided to shore up member states in the east and has come to an agreement that Canada, Turkey, Poland, the United States, Germany, and the Netherlands will set up a presence in Romania. The exact number and makeup of this presence is yet to be determined. Dmytro Potyekhin is a Kyiv-based political expert and trainer specializing in nonviolent resistance strategies and co-founder and CEO of the Nonviolent Solutions Agency. His experience includes work at the Embassy of Japan to Ukraine as a political analyst, management of a major civic campaign to prevent the falsification of the 2004 presidential elections in Ukraine, training hundreds of democracy activists around the world in nonviolent strategies, and also volunteers with a non-governmental organization that provides first aid medical training, and also as the head of the Kyiv City Police Reevaluation Committee. In 2010, he wrote that power in Ukraine was being usurped by the Yanukovych regime. He suggested then a strategy to stop the usurpation by denying to recognize and call Yanukovych the president of Ukraine. According to Dmytro, this would have increased chances for a change in loyalty among the security officers, making it easier for them to join the protesters and protect people. Dmytro has experience working as a freelance journalist and as a fixer with international media. In 2002, he helped to start the first public radio project in Ukraine as a manager of its internet programming. In 2014, he was writing material for a Canadian journal, and the assignment took him to terrorist-occupied Donetsk. On his way back to Kyiv, he was captured, but managed to get information out about his whereabouts. When asked by the Russian-backed terrorists to develop their propaganda, he refused. Eventually, he started a hunger strike and was released after 48 days in what he calls a concentration camp that was the city of Donetsk. He filed a case with the European Court of Human Rights and is currently finishing a book about his time as a prisoner of the Donetsk People's Republic. Dima, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting. It's great to have this conversation with you. Thank you. It was not an assignment. I was not going to Donetsk within an assignment from a Canadian journal. The assignment was to help write an article about what was going on in the country, and that was my own decision to go there. So that was risky, of course, and I tried to get prepared for possible risks, but that was my own decision. That's how I got there, and I managed to spend a day in the occupied city of Donetsk, and I was captured about 1 hour before my train back to Kyiv.
What were some of the impressions that the city had on you when you first saw this
town?
It's
very strange because it was almost empty, almost no people on the streets, and of course some signs of the terrorists around and the city being controlled by terrorists.
What do you mean by some of the signs?
Well, block posts, people armed, and lack of people on the streets. People were not happy with the situation. And, of course, they tried to hide, and lots of people already left the city that moment. Well, shellings and some buildings ruined. And that was a problem to get a taxi, because nobody wanted to go around the city when it is controlled by the terrorists.
They took your phone, and one of the things you wrote about is that they thought you were a spy because you had a Twitter account. Why do you think they associated Twitter with being a spy?
Well, I think it was not just about Twitter. They would associate with spying everything connected with the Western world culture and way of life. And because they are indoctrinated and anti-Western, anti-Ukrainian, and because they had very strong feelings about all those things, and they were looking for signs of people being part of their paranoia picture of the world. So they were using all those very natural and basic things as as a way to testify that actually, there is all that Western conspiracy against them, indeed. That's how, you know, any paranoid mind is operating, that actually you have some picture, it is installed in your mind by a propaganda machine, by repeating, and then to act in accordance with this picture, and then to excuse your very cruel actions, your mind is looking for signs that actually, yes, that paranoid picture is not paranoid, that is true, that actually there are enough reasons to kill people, to torture them, to bomb the city. And of course, when such signs and when facts are actually lacking for such a picture, of course, those paranoid minds, they are looking for signs and for anything which looks even remotely attached to that version of the reality, or even version of paranoid perception of the reality.
Several times you were put into relative isolation. One time, as a punishment for your complaining, you were put into a room with drug addicts and criminals. They were arresting all sorts of people, clearly, and holding you in the Isolatia factory that used to be a cultural platform. Now, you called it a concentration camp. Why?
Initially, I did not perceive that as a concentration camp, last summer I had a chance to visit Dachau concentration camp, the real concentration camp.
Where was
in Germany.
This?
It was in the summer of 2015. I had a chance to visit Augsburg, and I got a motorbike there, and I was traveling back home on the bike, and I managed to get to Dachau. I went there especially to see how it's different, and I was surprised to see lots of things in common with what I experienced in Donetsk. And of course, there were no gas cameras, and it was not so massive, not thousands of people, and not thousands of people killed. But the principles were 100% the same, and some of them even more harsh than in Dachau, in the German Nazi concentration camp. The Russian Nazi, I guess they are just not as good organized as German Nazis were. So that's why it took them longer to construct something like that, and they are still constructing that.
Right, they're still constructing a system of sorts, a penal system, if we can even call it that. Do you think they're acting on their own, or are they taking orders from someone with more experience?
I think it's both orders and general culture of authoritarianism and dictatorship. Because when I was interrogated by them, I could hear lots of wordings from Soviet and modern Russian movies about war, special forces, spies, and that was not something that people would necessarily get as a professional spies. I guess that some of them were just crazy volunteers who learned lots of things from Russian propaganda and Soviet propaganda. But some of them were definitely professionals, and once I was brought to be interrogated by FSB officer, and of course, on the top of the organization, it was professional Russian terrorism, not volunteers. And on the level of executives, lots of were in professional people, and that enabled me and other imprisoned smuggling some things into the cage and And one of the imprisoned even managed to escape during a clash. There were clash between two different terrorist groups for for champagne stolen in the street, and or for actually two cars of champagne, and so another group of terrorists came to get it back, and armed clash started, and siege of this Izolatsia concentration camp by another group of terrorists, and several imprisoned were out of the cell at the moment, and one of them managed to escape.
Who were some of the other prisoners that were with you?
Lots of people. And surprising was that most of them were locals. And I was just probably one from Kyiv, and there were among several hundreds of people I met there, just several guys from other parts of the country. But most of them were locals. And I think that this is what actually helps break any authoritarian system, that it basically works against the people because of that paranoia, because of their idea that there are spies and, you know, guys helping to shell the city. And they were sure that Ukrainians were shelling the city. I was not sure. I don't know. I'm not a military expert. So when they wanted me to work for their propaganda, they wanted me to write that actually, you know, I saw victims of Ukrainian operations, and that, guys, I mean, I can see the buildings being broken, but I don't know who did that. I'm not an expert, so I denied on the ground that actually, no, it's not a fact.
But they threatened you several times. They interrogated you several times. You witnessed several beatings. You announced a hunger strike, and yet you took care to make sure that the people you were being held with, that they were still given food. Fear is clearly part of the penal system there. What was one of the worst things that you witnessed?
Well, of course, when somebody is shooting behind your head and giving you orders, then it's tough. But that was closer to the end of the of my stay there, or of what turned out to be end of my stay there. But at the moment, I was more shocked when I just got there, because closer to the end, in several weeks, you're getting used to very nasty things, you know. But I was shocked with the local people and women held in the same room, and they were not let out to go to toilet and to use restroom. And that's why I actually I'm not complaining, because there is no system of no complaints. There is no rule of law. There was no accusation. There was no procedure, no court. I was just asking, I mean, guys, is it kind of torture room? What are you doing here with us? I mean, if it's detention, then, okay, provide the rights of the detained people. And, you know, I am more or less okay. And it was just a third day. But there were old ladies, and of course, that was a problem for them, and they were not let out to toilet for several hours, although they were asking, and I asked about, you know, actually their rights, and that made the deputy head of that concentration camp very angry, and in half an hour he moved me to the worst cell in the whole camp, and I was kept there for 3 days, and there were 10 people more in a tiny place with no windows and no water in the second and third day, and we were not given a chance to remove anything from the cell, and that was really tough. And there were some drug users who were, or substitution treatment clients who were not giving their medicines because The terrorists did not have any idea of how it works and why they need medicine. They just believe them to be drug addicts, and that's it. So they and at the same time these terrorists, they were sure that they're helping, you know, to fight against fascists, Nazis, and you know, alcoholism, and of course that was very Soviet.
What was the thing you remember most when you were released?
That is, of course, I heard the Ukrainian language, because when we crossed the block posts, we stopped in the first village on the part of Ukraine controlled by Ukraine, and we went into a drugstore, and I tried to get some medicines because I got problems with stomach. And a friend of mine, a Western journalist who helped me get out of Donetsk, he wanted to buy me that, and I said, "Oh, no, Roman, can I do it myself?" And I asked her in Ukrainian, and I heard she answered in Ukrainian, and that was, and I really felt as like, okay, now I believe that I'm free. That was the moment and the real sign that actually, yeah, we can be free and I can enjoy it, and that's, I'm home.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, Dmytro Potyakhin, we look forward to the book. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me tonight. Thank you.
Remember the movie Ace Ventura, Pet Detective? Well, sometimes life does in fact imitate art. Activists were protesting outside the Kyiv City Hall, demanding the creation of a pet police. They want the city to create a special unit that would protect homeless animals from dog hunters that prey on the city's homeless pet population and raise awareness about animal cruelty. In an interview on Hromadske Radio, an activist said that they want to create a pet patrol that would protect animal rights, specifically domestic pets, from cruelty. They created a petition online and got enough signatures to put the issue on the docket for the Kyiv City Council to consider. Eurovision is coming to Ukraine in 2017, and now there's money to make it happen. The Kyiv City Council announced that they will be earmarking 200 million hryvnia for the show. The government of Ukraine has also said that the new budget will allocate 456 million hryvnia to prepare for Eurovision in Ukraine. That's almost 20 million US dollars. Eurovision 2016, one of the largest European song contests, was won by Jamala for her song 1944 about Stalin's forced deportation of hundreds of thousands of Crimean Tatars from their homeland. Over 41 countries have announced their participation in Eurovision 2017. They will be held at Kyiv's International Exhibition Center that can host about 11,000 attendees. This is the second time that the contest will be held in Kyiv since 2005. A song I'd like to leave you with is by Plach Yeremi, or Jeremiah's Cry, called Lish Vona, or Only Her, that remains very popular in Ukraine. You can hear it sung by people playing guitar around town and at entrances to the metro.
Порусифікований містах. дешевого вина. Моя дівчинко печальна, моя доле золота, я продовжую кричати, ніч безмежна і пуста. Я люблю її тонкі уста. Та невдовзі прийде осінь, ми усі розбіжимося по русифікованих містах. Лиш вона безмежна і пуста, я продовжую кричати, ніч безмежна і пуста, я продовжую кричати, ніч безмежна і пуста.
Tune in next week for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. If you have any suggestions or comments, feel free to write the show at ukrainecalling@hromadskyradio.org. I'm Marco Supran in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.